Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how propaganda works, particularly in democratic settings. With us is Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley. It's great to have you here. Your new book, How Propaganda Works, you do a real philosophical look at this and a bit of a historic look, especially through modern history. How does propaganda in a liberal democratic state differ from, say, propaganda in a more authoritarian, totalitarian state?
Excellent and very prescient question right now. As I say in my book, the difficulty, there's sort of reverse difficulties. In an authoritarian state, the problem with propaganda is that people don't believe it. People don't believe when the leaders say things, people don't believe that they're going to go through on what they say because they say it's just propaganda. And you find this repeatedly throughout the literature on authoritarianism. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, has a whole chapter on this where he talks about how no one would believe that Hitler was really anti-Semitic. And my grandmother wrote one of the first Holocaust memoirs in the English language called The Unforgotten, which is a very important book to read right now, sadly out of print. And she talks again and again about this. She didn't leave Germany until August 1939. And she talks about a kind of refusal to believe that National Socialists were serious. And there was a period in time in Nazi Germany when there were parties, where my grandmother speaks of this, where she's at parties with Gestapo officers and SS officers who are like, well, we don't mean you. Come on. So in authoritarian societies, people just dismiss what's said. In liberal democratic societies, people don't believe there's propaganda. So they don't believe leaders can be lying or misleading. And so what I think you're seeing now is a blurring together, you sort of, as people employ authoritarian tactics in liberal democratic society, you're finding people saying, oh, come on, that's just propaganda. Whereas earlier they would have either said, oh, they're wrong, or they must know something. The propaganda of liberal democratic societies is that there's no propaganda. And what happens in authoritarian societies is that people too willingly dismiss it as mere propaganda. And most importantly, in authoritarian propaganda, you invent reality. And I don't really discuss this in my book, and I've tried to make up for it in my subsequent newspaper articles. But in an authoritarian society, the authoritarian leader demonstrates their power by creating reality. In an authoritarian society, the main principle is power. In a liberal democratic society, the main principles are equal respect and truth, which work together. So in an authoritarian society, what happens is that the leader wants to strengthen certain ideologies. So the leader demonstrates the leader's power by simply strengthening, making up reality to strengthen the flawed ideologies people already have. So they might say, there's a wave of violent crime. Or they might say, immigration poses a fundamental threat to our freedoms. Or they might give example, they might invent the reality that will lead people to strengthen the ideology that they're already susceptible to. So if in the United States election, we saw repeated claims that American cities were in flames and there was the highest crime rates ever, even though we're close to historic lows in crime. And that was an invention of reality to strengthen an ideology. And in authoritarian societies, people like power. People admire powerful leaders. So a leader demonstrates their power by inventing reality. In a liberal democratic society, there are strong norms to punish anyone who clearly violates, who says false things. And you know that liberal democratic values are crumbling when you see politicians being rewarded for inventing reality rather than being punished.
This is partly why you argue that propaganda threatens liberal democracies.
Yes, propaganda is a terrible threat to liberal democracies, but it can also be what's required to help liberal democracies. Propaganda can be used as a weapon to restore democratic ideals. For example, it can be directed against bad ideals. And this is what I discuss in my book under the label of civic rhetoric. Civic rhetoric, I'm very much devoted to the ideals of liberty and equality, and I might try to restore those goals, as Du Bois argues in his 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art. I might restore those ideals by focusing on flawed ideals and showing how they're in tension with freedom and equality. So Du Bois calls for artists to appeal to white audiences with negative images, with the sort of images, dehumanizing images of Black American citizens as mere dancers, people who dance and joke. But then within that paradigm, draw them into the theater that way, but then explode those negative ideals, undermine those negative ideals by showing the humanity of some of our fellow citizens who have been unfairly caricatured. And you can see this happening in the early 1990s with rap and hip hop. That was supposed to, there was a crisis of mass incarceration. There was a crisis of over-policing, a lack of empathy. And you had American citizens, descendants of enslaved Americans, producing music that was attempting to show that people in the situation were human, and they were in fact being subjugated by these harsh, punitive ideologies. But they drew listeners in by, quote unquote, glorifying violence.
One of the things about this particular issue that you wrote about in the preface of the book, when you were talking about mass incarceration, what struck me was your discussion about how this robs potential, the ideology of this, the propaganda of this, the false beliefs about this. Can you elaborate on that a bit, on the human potential aspect of this?
For the case of mass incarceration?
Sure. And if you want to connect that to the wider structures of society.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply influenced. I stand on the shoulders of feminist theorists and Black American theorists whose work I employ, and particularly scholars of American mass incarceration. So I'm teaching, for example, Elizabeth Hinton's book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, to the War on Drugs, which is an account of the Nixon administration's propaganda that created a system that incarcerates somewhere between 2.2 million and 2.5 million people in its prisons, both federal, state, and local. Our incarceration rate is 752 per 100,000, which dwarfs any other nations in the world. Russia is second at 500 some out of 100,000. And the next liberal democracy is the UK at 150 or 149 per 100,000. So our incarceration rate is staggeringly high. And we have eight times the rate that we did in 1973. In 1973, we had 300,000 people in prison, jail, or federal prison. Now we have between 2 and 2.5 million. And 8 million people on probation or parole, which is brutal in the United States. It prevents you from getting jobs, et cetera. So what happened? So what happened was in the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement involved a lot of protests. And some of that protest turned violent, like in Detroit, famously. And what Nixon did when he took office is he changed the narrative from social justice and equal rights to law and order. And he repainted and redescribed the protests as riots. So, and we find the same thing happening today, by the way. If you look at Fox News and their descriptions of what happened in Baltimore, a city that was racked by protests over police malfeasance, police misconduct, you see Fox News describes the protests as riots. Use the word riot 7 words out of 1,000 in its reports about Baltimore. And they used protest less than 3 words out of 1,000. CNN was more even-handed. They used the word riot just under 4 words per 100 per 1,000, and the word protest just over 3 words and per 1,000 in describing Baltimore. And MSNBC used protests slightly more than riots in describing what was happening in Baltimore. This is why I said that you can't define propaganda as, you know, skewed discourse, because each word carries this way of skewing reality. I mean, there were people and they were gathering and they were doing things, but how you describe it is going to really affect the uptake. So Nixon redescribed what was happening, not as protests, but as riots, and then shifted the nation's attention from the ideals of equality and social justice to law and order. And then he applied law and order in a way that undermined law and order, because he applied it unequally, where it fell particularly harshly on Black Americans and political dissidents. This year, his statement, Elizabeth Hinton, I think, discovered this. I'm not sure who discovered this, but it was revealed in the past year that Nixon said, we're going to have a war on drugs and we'll target marijuana to get the hippies and we'll target heroin to get the Blacks. So it was explicitly, and then we'll humiliate them on national television over and over again. So Abby Hoffman was caught up in this. And what happened is you shifted the nation's attention from one set of ideals to another. And you could do this with, you know, you could shift. And we've seen this happen with the Syrian refugee crisis. At first, social justice saved these refugees, and then it was shifted to, you know, danger, terrorism, law and order, protect us. So then what happens when you shift the ideals, then you can filter them through a flawed ideology. So that you can see that the war on drugs was a flawed filtered through a flawed racist ideology. You can see this from the differential reaction to the opiate and heroin crisis devastating white communities today, which is dealt with by empathy, versus the early 70s reaction to Black heroin usage, which was where it was only punitive and there was no empathy at all. So Americans had in the early 70s and today, have a flawed racist ideology. So when you have law and order there centered, and they think of, say, drug use by Black fellow citizens, their reaction is punitive. But when they think of drug use by white fellow citizens, their reaction is empathetic. So mass incarceration is law and order differentially applied through flawed ideology, racial ideologies. But that undermines law and order, democratic law and order, because at the very core of democratic law and order is fairness and impartiality. And so we should have the same reaction to a 16-year-old white heroin user and a 16-year-old Black heroin user. And we see quite clearly from American history that our government does not have the same reaction. We can see that Nixon, when he was calling for law and order in the face of these protests, and when he was calling for law and order in the face of a drug crisis, was relying on the flawed racist ideology. And that's why he said, you know, we're going to have a war on drugs to target the Blacks.
Would you say that inequality feeds propaganda, or that propaganda is creating inequality, or is this a mutual system?
It's a mutual system. The flawed ideology arises from inequality, because those who benefit from inequality have a legitimation myth. They have to tell themselves that they deserve their place. They deserve it. And so when it's so clear that they don't deserve it, say birth position, I mean, you do nothing to deserve your own birth position. So those who are born into a privileged birth position, whether by gender, by sexual orientation, by race, by citizenship status, tend to think that they deserve it. And so when there's inequality, that gives rise to this flawed ideology that protects you from having to face your own complicity in structural injustice. And then that allows propaganda to flourish, because a flawed ideology is what prevents you from recognizing the inconsistency between the ideal and the goal. I mean, what could explain the radically differential reaction Americans have to white heroin use versus black heroin use, other than a very different conception of those whom they should regard as equals. So when you have a flawed ideology, a legitimation, when you have inequality, unless you want to face your own complicity, which requires action and sacrifice, you're going to have a legitimation myth. And that legitimation myth is there and is in place to prevent you from seeing certain aspects of social reality. For example, that you don't deserve where you are, that you inherited it. So that has to be in place. And hey, it's your social identity to occupy that level to reap the benefits of inequality, because most of your friends will be in similar positions. So your social identity will be tied to that legitimation myth, and that will allow propaganda that feeds into your own legitimation myth, your own flawed ideology, to be effective.
It seems also that in order to even challenge your beliefs or that ideology that you're talking about, you would have to have information that would counter it. And, you know, people are not always looking around for that type of information that then they would have to question, well, why is it this way?
Right. So information bubbles. So what a flawed ideology does is it enables you, even when confronted with the information, to disregard it. So, for example, certain politicians have successfully portrayed universities as giving, as, you know, the sources of falsehood, and climate scientists as the purveyors of flawed ideology. So people discount the information that they're given from those sources. But if you don't even have access to the sources, if you only get information from venues that strengthen your own flawed ideologies or your own ideologies, you know, then matters are unfortunately quite hopeless.
There's been quite a bit of research among psychologists and political psychologists and such about a couple of phenomena here. One is that when you do get information that is counter to what you really believe, that there is a cognitive dissonance that makes it very uncomfortable to listen to. And I think that is one factor here. How do you suggest we deal with something like that?
It's, well, what to do is always the hardest. And I take myself as a chronicler of what is, but we now have to shift into what to do. You have a cognitive dissonance because, you know, all theories of ideology must explain the facts to which you're drawing our attention. We don't like to hear information that's inconsistent with our legitimation myths, that's inconsistent with the beliefs that form our ideology. So they're very uncomfortable. We seek alternative explanations. So one thing that could be done is diversifying our friend groups so that people are reached. Unfortunately, this strategy is tricky because it's been used to argue that we should have more people involved who have really problematic ideologies. So, and it's true, it would be good to have a sense of what undergirds someone who, say, hates my people, Jewish people, you know, to understand where they're coming from. But I do think, you know, it's important to somehow, I don't think we can approach the question about what to do without being clear that some views are true and some are not true. And there are various ways to find out what's true, and the scientific method is one, and empirical research. I mean, what happens in the university? I mean, I'm very, you know, methods and practices of investigating the world are parts of our ideologies. And you and I believe in the methods and practices of the Enlightenment or something like that, what happens in universities. And, you know, the problem we now face is that there are people who challenge those methods. They say, no, science is ideological. And so how do you address that? How do you address that without having some societal decision that these methods, for instance, scientific methods, are to be trusted? I'm not sure you can overcome that. We just have to recognize that there are facts out there, and when we give up on that, we're sunk. And then we need to discuss, you know, whether the methodology used by, say, climate science is a good way to find out what the facts are. And you look at the people who disparage climate science, and they have strong financial interests in so doing. And you can sort of point that out, maybe. But I don't know if there's any way. One has to have truth as a value, and there has to be intersubjective agreement on basic methods for discovering the truth. And what I'm concerned about now is that that ground has been undermined.
On a much lesser scale, even in the academy itself, there can be problems that we are ourselves blind to. And you point that out rightfully in your preface of your book.
Yes. I mean, the academy is what justified mass incarceration. So absolutely right. Yeah. Often what happens is the societal ideologies get through to the academy and then are, as it were, whitewashed, you know, and then handed back to society as a legitimation of their legitimation. So this is what happened with mass incarceration when John DiIulio, a professor at Princeton University, came up with super predator theory with Vincent Fox of Northeastern. And so then they, you know, deeply affected the 1990s, the criminal justice debate. He said there's a generation of super predators growing up, and he predicted a fivefold increase in violent crime. And so between 1995 and 2000, violent crime has dropped precipitously in the United States between 1995 and 2000. So you could say by the standards of the academy, those errors get found out. But you're absolutely right that statistics, we're not God. We're not even, you know, we have a limited amount of time to find things out, even via scientific research. So certain hypotheses we have to discard. Certain hypotheses are going to seem more sensible to us. And because we have just a limit, we're only on Earth for 80 years if we're lucky. You know, we have a limited time. We can't investigate every possibility. It's going to be our pre-existing ideologies that determine which hypotheses we find more likely. And so the university is going to be deeply affected by the external ideologies of society because we can't investigate every possibility. We only have time on this earth and within the confines of a junior faculty career to get tenure. You only have a few years. So you have to look at hypotheses that will maximize your chances of getting tenure, maximizes your chances of getting research support, which means if your government happens to be xenophobic, or as happened in the early 1990s with drug policy, as the Columbia neuroscientist Carl Hart has documented in his book, High Price, research money went to those who said that drugs are really, really, really bad. And what happened is that people produced experiments where they gave mice like an amount of cocaine that would kill a human. And they said, look, cocaine is bad for you. Yeah. Or they had this experiment where they, you know, the famous experiment where they put cocaine and, you know, I'm not recommending the use of cocaine by any means. But nevertheless, you know, there was a tremendous amount of drug propaganda that Carl Hart documents presented under the guise of science. Famous experiment, you put a mouse in a cage and you give them the choice of taking cocaine or eating food. And the mice decide each time to take the cocaine rather than the food, and they die. So this was used in policy. And then someone else did an experiment where they added a running wheel to the cage. And what they found is that the mice did not die and often ate the food because they would run on the running wheel and weren't as bored. So in the first experiment, the mice were literally bored to death. So absolutely right. The incentive structure changes radically. The incentive structure for the university is a function of the greater society. And that means that the clear distinction I wanted to draw can't be drawn.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful interview.
Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works.
This is part two of a two-part interview. To listen to the entire interview, please go to scholarcircle.org.